Let me ask you this. I was kind of curious on, after watching this, how many of you seen this movie or documentary called Free Solo? Anybody seen? Some of you? It's a couple years old now. If you have Disney Plus, which I know some of you probably do, you can watch it free on Disney Plus. But it's about an American rock climber named Alex Honnold. He had made some waves earlier. He had climbed Half Dome as a free solo thing, and that kind of made waves. And by free solo, that means you climb up a mountain without any rope and without any help or a partner. So that's why free solo. And so he was making waves. He actually was on 60 Minutes a couple years ago. I saw him on that. And then 2 years ago, he did something that no one thought was probably even possible. He climbed up El Capitan free solo. And that's 3,200 feet straight up this granite rock. Amazing thing. And he did it in under 4 hours. Now, to kind of help you put that in perspective, the first team that went up El Capitan and made it all the way up with this expedition was led by a guy named Warren Harding, not the president, but he was in 1958. He had a team, and it took them about 45 days to climb the 3,200-foot rock. Alex did it and got back before lunch. That is, to me, incredibly impressive. And so I'm watching this as a documentary, and the cool part is that everybody kind of knew that this was one of his big goals, visions for his life was to do this, and so he was preparing for years to do this, and so a documentary team followed him along, which was neat. They followed his preparations, and then they were able to capture this whole 4 hours on camera. It's unbelievable. And it's just neat to watch, because throughout this documentary, you have these other climbers just talking about how ridiculously hard this would be, and just the challenge of this, the risk of this, and you watch Alex. He would do so much preparation. He would, rope in and go down and work on different sections, and he would talk about how this section was incredibly hard, and you would see him try a move, and then he would fall, but he had a rope on that during that time, and so you're watching him then doing this whole climb, and you're just kind of like gripped to your seat. You know he's going to make it. You know he's alive, but it's still just, it's just amazing just what he did. And one of the really interesting things when you hear his story is that he confesses, he's like, listen, I was never like the strongest, most talented rock climber, in my age group or the guys I was climbing with. I didn't have this natural ability like other guys did. What Alex Honnold had was this incredible focus, this commitment to doing this what seemingly impossible thing. He said that when he climbed Half Dome, he had this one point where he was feeling like he was going to slip and fall, and he wasn't sure about this foothold because he didn't do the preparation work. And he got lucky, he said, when he did Half Dome. He says, I don't want to ever do that again. I want to be lucky. So he put so much time and preparation. His focus and preparation was unbelievable, to the point where 3,200 feet up, think about how many handholds that would take to get up to the top. He said, I had basically every handhold memorized, every foothold memorized. He could like walk through it in his sleep. He was so well prepared, and he was so focused on it. He basically reoriented his whole life to this one endeavor of becoming a master rock climber by climbing up El Capitan. He had just incredible focus, not just simply in his preparation, but you can imagine during the climb how focused you would be, because one slip of a finger, because some of these holds was just like a little thumb and a little finger, and that was his hold. One slip, and you're gone. And so just imagine the kind of focus that he had throughout this whole four-hour ordeal. In fact, that's what kind of makes successful people successful, isn't it? If you look at successful people and whatever field that is, science, art, mathematics, whatever it is, when people achieve, great accomplishments, they always have one thing in common. There's always this tremendous focus that they have on completing the mission, completing the vision of whatever it is they're trying to achieve. I mean, they're willing to sacrifice so much to get there. In fact, oftentimes when you're focused on a vision, when you're focused on here's where I'm going, It comes at a great cost because you have to say no to all those other things that get in the way that distract you from the vision. You know, for example, for Alex, you know, he lived in a van down by the river, you know, basically. I mean, he slept in his van. He had to say no to so many things. And not the fact that, I mean, he had other things going on. He had a girlfriend during the documentary. I think they're still together. They bought a house together. It wasn't like he didn't do anything else, but you knew his primary focus was on climbing El Capitan and becoming this master rock climber, as he puts it. But it always comes with a cost. It always comes with a cost. And so, you know, as we get into our last part of our series, let me just ask you this. You know, nobody guessed what Alex Honnold was focused on. Let me ask you this. What are you focused on? What are you focused on? What has your undivided attention? And you might say, that's just it, Dave. It's not that I'm just focused on one. I have so many things I'm focused on. I have like 100 things I'm focused on. You know, I got work and I got kids and I got sports. I got this business I'm trying to start up. I got this fiance. We're planning a wedding. I got this. I got this. I got two dogs. I got two cats. You know, whatever it is, I got so many plates spinning. It's like, what am I focused on? Maybe the better question is, what am I not focused on? Because it just seems like there's so many things that I kind of keep doing. And see, this is where we're talking about this idea of where we're headed in vision and the power of vision. In fact, we started this whole series by talking about when we got into this building, this new building of ours, we said it didn't start with the workers, it didn't start with the building materials, it started with this vision on the wall, this picture on the wall. We said this is what we wanted to build, and we didn't know how much it was going to cost. We didn't know what the carpet was going to be. We didn't know where all the outlets were going to go. We just had a picture on the wall. This is where we wanted to end up. And we put all of our focus and all of our energies towards building the picture on the wall. And so the question that we started with this series is, where do you want to end up in life? Where do you want to end up at the end of your life? In other words, like, what's your vision, right? And that's the power of vision. And we said the power of vision is, hey, when you know where you want to go, where you want to end up, that gives you permission to say yes to anything that moves you towards the vision. And we said it gives you permission to say no to anything that pushes you away to the vision. And as Jesus followers, here's the good news, we said. The good news is that we don't have to look far to have our vision, because Jesus gives us, I think, a very clear picture of what our vision should be as we follow him. Because we said we know two very important things. We know what God is concerned with. We know that God is concerned with people. Ultimately, it's people. It's people who are far from him relationally. It's people who are broken and people who need help, people who need restoration, people who need him. That's what he's concerned with. We know God is concerned with ultimately rescuing people and restoring people. And that's our first two parts of our vision. And we also said the good news is we know what God is up to in history. We know God, know how God is going to accomplish this task of rescuing and restoring. We know his plan. And that plan is what I want to really talk with you about this morning. So in order to do that, we need to kind of talk about the same guy that we've been talking about for a couple weeks. And his name was Peter. Some of you know him as Saint Peter or the Apostle Peter. Peter was one of Jesus's closest disciples, if not the closest disciple. And we looked at how, you know, Peter followed Jesus. Now, to understand what we mean by disciple, that's kind of a Christianese word. Let me explain in the first century world what a disciple was for just a real quick moment. When you were a young Jewish boy, you were brought into a Jewish school, if there was one in that town, and you were taught to read and write the Old Testament, which was not old to them. It was the Hebrew scriptures. And you were learning how to read and write and even memorize some large portions of scripture. And for those who demonstrated an exceptional ability to memorize and to wrestle with the Old Testament text, the Hebrew scriptures, you would then move on to a secondary schooling. And for those who showed great aptitude and ability in the secondary schooling, they were encouraged to go out and look for a rabbi, a teacher, that they could follow and imitate. And so they would go out and find a rabbi, and they would ask the rabbi, can I come and follow you? And the rabbi would look them up and down and say yes or no. And if they said yes, then for years they may follow this rabbi, imitating, trying to imitate every single thing about this rabbi, just to the very, you know, smallest degree. To the point where it would be one day where the rabbi would turn to his disciple and he would say something to this extent. He would say, as far as it is possible, you are like me. Now go and seek others who will imitate you because you are like me. And when they imitate you, they will be like me. In other words, you've become like me enough where if you go out and start helping other people imitate you, that's me reproducing you and others. You know, over and over, that's the whole reproduction thing. And then they would become a disciple maker and they would go out and make disciples. That's how it worked in the first century world. But Jesus kind of turned everything upside down. Instead of waiting for Peter to come to Jesus, Jesus goes to Peter, which he's a fisherman. In fact, we're told that he's an ordinary, unschooled fisherman. So apparently he didn't have what it took to go all the way through the schooling and find a rabbi. He didn't have that abilities. And yet Jesus chose him and he said, come and follow me. In fact, we looked at this passage a couple times. Come, follow me, he says, and I will send you out to fish for people. I will reorient your life. I will give you a new vision, new purpose if you come and follow me. And we're told that, of course, Peter and Andrew, James and John and others like Matthew left everything and followed after Jesus. And their focus was on becoming like Jesus, becoming like the rabbi. But we're told that Peter lost his focus at times. In fact, one of the biggest times he lost his focus, we're told last week that we looked at, that he basically denied Jesus three different times. And we looked through that story and how broken he was afterwards and how he went away and wept bitterly because he had denied even knowing Jesus three different times. And yet we're told that after Jesus was tried and crucified and buried and rose again, he came back alive and he began showing himself to the disciples. And then one just incredible moment on the beach, on the Sea of Galilee, Jesus invites Peter to have a conversation with him, to restore him, not just emotionally or relationally, but also positionally. And he says to Peter, he says, listen, I want you to take care of my sheep. Three different times, he says, take care of my sheep, take care of the lambs, take care of my sheep, feed my lambs. In other words, Peter, I know you think you failed, but I'm bringing you back and I'm restoring you and I want you to lead. Now you're the perfect person to lead, as we talked about. Now you understand your brokenness, but you also understand my grace. This puts you in a great position. Now go and take care of my sheep. And then Jesus says, just so interesting to me, he reiterates the same call he made to Peter the first time of the call. He says this, follow me, follow me. You know, he says, Peter, I want you to remember who you are. You're my disciple. Come follow me. Come be like me. And then we're told that, again, Jesus would appear to these guys seemingly randomly for 40 days after his resurrection and before his ascension. And we're told that the disciples got word that Jesus told them to go, somehow got word to go to Galilee to this mountain. And so Matthew tells us this, that then the 11 disciples, says, went to Galilee, the place where most of the ministry happened. Now, again, he says 11 here, but for some of us, you know, some people think there probably is more than 11. I'll explain why in a minute. But some people think that perhaps there was up to 500, that this is maybe when Peter said in 1 Corinthians 15 that Jesus appeared to over 500, that may be this particular scene here that we're seeing. We're not quite sure, but there's at least 11 up to maybe, 511. We're not really sure. But they go to Galilee. And it says the 11 disciples and maybe some others went to Galilee to the mountain where Jesus had told them to go. Now, what's interesting, we read right over this, but this is, I think, very, very important point. If you've ever been to Israel, and I got to go a few years ago, if you ever go by the Sea of Galilee, it doesn't say which mountain, but you have a pretty good guess. We all have a pretty good guess which mountain they're talking about, because there's like one really prominent high point mountain next to the Sea of Galilee, and that is this mountain called Mount Arbel. And this is a picture that I took on our way up to Mount Arbel. If you look closely, you can see Alex Arnold actually rock climbing up the side. No, I'm just joking. But this is walking up. This is kind of the face of it on top there. If you get on top of Mount Arbel, you have this incredible view of just basically the Sea of Galilee and basically 70% of Jesus' ministry, you could just point out right here. I mean, you can see where Jesus calls his disciples. You can see the towns of Bethsaida and Chorazin, and, you know, where the disciples are from. You can see where Magdala was, where Mary Magdalene's from. I mean, you can see where Jesus, you know, had dinner or breakfast on the beach with Peter. You could see where the Sermon on the Mount took place. You could see across, you know, where they fed the, you know, the 4,000, the demoniac, and all those kind of things happening. All these incredible stories, Jesus brings them up on this mountaintop, and I think he's showing them basically, hey, you guys remember all these things that we did together? All these things that you witnessed, all these events? It's kind of like this giant montage all at once. This incredible view and scene. You can just see it all from right here. And he brings them up to this mountain. And as they're walking up, and again, the prior picture, you can see, you can see people on the very top, and you walk up and you're seeing people there. And it says that when they saw Jesus, when they saw him, they worshiped him, but some doubted. Now, to me, this is, again, another fascinating part of the story that Matthew includes for us. It says that there were those who worshiped him. Why? Well, because he had claimed to be the Son of God. He claimed to be God in the flesh, one with God. And then he predicted his death and his burial and his resurrection, and he pulled it off. So if someone who claims to be the Son of God, you know, predicts all that and pulls it off, obviously that's who this person is. And so they begin worshiping, which is huge for any young Jewish man or even woman to bow their knee to anyone but the one true God. And here they are worshiping Jesus as God, because that's who he is. And Jesus doesn't say, no, you got the wrong guy. That he receives their worship because that's who he is. He deserves their worship because he is God in the flesh. And yet Matthew, so interestingly, says that some doubted, which I think is just so fascinating, that the fact that Matthew would include this, and this is one of the reasons why I think you should believe what Matthew is saying is true, because why would you add this if otherwise it was not true? And this is why I think maybe it was more than just the 11 who were there. This is why I think maybe it was even the 500, because there were some who didn't really believe yet, which, you know, begs the point, why didn't they believe? I mean, here's Jesus standing there, I mean, holes in his hands after the crucifixion, after the resurrection. And there they are, this whole scene of them worshiping, and yet some doubted. Why did they doubt? And my answer is, well, clearly, I don't think it was because of a lack of evidence, because Jesus is standing right there. See, some of you maybe in this room right now are maybe skeptical of, like, Jesus actually being the Son of God, actually being God in the flesh. And I understand that. That's a huge statement to make. And for you, it's like, I just wish I had more evidence. I just wish I had more evidence. I wish I had more evidence. Well, here are these people, and they have evidence galore. I mean, they're standing next to the guy. And yet that evidence wasn't enough, because I don't think it was an evidence issue for these doubters here. To me, I think this was probably more of an issue of the heart. That they just weren't willing to surrender, weren't willing to bow their knee to Jesus yet. And for some of you, maybe you say, I just need more evidence. But maybe it's not evidence that you need, because we have still plenty of evidence. We have these eyewitness accounts that we were there, we saw it. We have plenty of evidence. Maybe for you, it's an issue of the heart too, if you're willing to explore that issue. But Jesus doesn't say, you know what, you doubters, go away. He doesn't do any of that. They're free to come. They're free to explore. They're free to question and doubt and wrestle with this. And then Jesus, you know, after receiving their worship, came to them and said something that if I stood up here and said, here's what you would do. You would look at the person you came with and said, let's get out of here, right? You know, you get the kids, I'll get the car, and we're out of here. Because what Jesus says next is so audacious, so over the top, that if anybody else would say this, you would be so concerned, you would say, let's get out of here immediately. Here's what Jesus says. He said, he came to them and said, all authority in heaven and on earth has been given to me. I mean, can you imagine anyone else saying this and being taken seriously? Anybody else, they would get laughed right off that mountaintop. But here's Jesus back from the dead. Here's Jesus who predicted all this. Here's Jesus who had done so many, you know, just amazing things already. And no one's laughing and no one's walking away. But Jesus is saying, I have all authority. I have exousia. I have power. I have all the power in heaven. It's like, wait a minute, Jesus, who has all the power? I thought God had all the power in heaven. Jesus is like, yeah, exactly. And I have all the power in heaven, and not just in heaven, but I have all power on earth as well. That nothing happens on this earth without my say so. I hold the whole world in my hands. That is such a huge statement, guys. That I am king, I am Lord. I'm telling you though, this is what Christians went around proclaiming. This is what Christians went around proclaiming and believing, and this is what got them into so much trouble. It wasn't the loving thing that got them into trouble. I mean, who's going to, you know, reject someone who loves you? It was Jesus is Lord. Jesus is King. Caesar isn't the real Lord of Lords. Jesus is the Lord of Lords. And this is what got them into so much mess. But this is what they believed, and this is what they hung on to. This is what they clinged to, that Jesus had all authority. And this is, for some of us, maybe what you need to hear this morning. Because I know right now it seems like life does not seem like it's going the way you wanted it. It seems chaotic. It seems like a mess. It seems like things are out of your hands, out of control. And it seems like, you know, it's like, what is going on? And you just need to be reminded. And I sometimes need to be reminded that Jesus has all authority on earth as he does in heaven. And he says this incredible claim. And why does he say this? Because of what he's about to do next. What he's about to do next is to give them a vision for their future, a plan for their lives that they never thought that they would be doing. He says this. He says, therefore, in light of what I just said, therefore, in light of what you've seen in me and seen about me, you've witnessed all these incredible things that we're just, you know, being reminded of being on this mountaintop. He says, therefore, the fact that I have died for your sins, was buried and rose again and came back to life, therefore, because of who I am, because I have all authority on heaven and earth, he says, go and make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit and teaching them to obey everything I've commanded you. He says, go. Go and basically make disciples the way I have discipled you. I want you to go make disciples of all nations. Now, this word nations does not mean countries. This word nations is from the word ethnos. It means where we get our word ethnicity from or ethnic from. It means any people group that have a shared common language and common culture. And there are far more ethnoses in the world than countries in the world. So just imagine, Jesus says, just imagine every nation, every ethnos, there are followers of me, people who are trying to imitate my life, walk behind me, following me, learning from me, becoming like me, from every tongue, tribe, and nation. He says, I want you to picture this. At every corner of the world, there would be disciples who are making disciples who are making disciples. Jesus gives them a universal mission and a universal vision because he has universal authority. I mean, this is the only reason that, why should we believe this? Why should we do this? This is insane. This is crazy. We need to reorient our lives to this one thing of making disciples, Jesus. This is what you want us to go and do? Why would we ever do that? Unless Jesus has all authority, unless he really is the king of our lives. And what Jesus is doing is it's graduation day for these disciples. Right? This is Jesus' way of saying what the rabbis would say, right? Remember what the rabbi would say? Now go and seek others who will imitate you because you are like me. And when they imitate you, they will be like me. That's what he's telling them. He's saying, I want you to go reproduce yourself. I want you to go make disciples. That's really the only command in this text. It's make disciples. The other things, the going, the teaching, the baptizing, those are participles. That's what you do. That's kind of how you do it. And so let's talk about that for a second. What does it mean by going? Going means moving out beyond ourselves, moving out into other people's lives, moving out being relational, intentional. Some of you have heard the phrase, going means really as you are going, that kind of language. It means to move in. We've talked about this, guys. This is why we've talked about moving into our neighborhoods and our workplaces and our friends' lives and our families' lives. Moving in, going where they are, not waiting for them to come to us, but going out. We need to be moving out. That's part of the life of a disciple maker. It's not staying in. It's not waiting and hoping, man, I hope they come. I hope they ask me this question. I hope they get interested. No, I need to move into their life in a way that is attractive, that invites questions, that that really opens up the door for conversations. We need to be moving in, going out. But it's also this idea of baptizing. He says baptizing, and baptism is something that we do here when someone comes to Jesus and comes and puts their faith in Jesus. Baptism is simply an outward expression of an inward faith. Baptism is an incredibly symbolic gesture. It has so many different rich undertones. It means that when you come under the water, you come out, there's this whole picture of I'm giving my life over to Jesus, and I'm kind of dying to my old life, and I'm coming up, and I'm a brand new person. I'm being washed in the sense, that symbolism of wash. You know, baptism never saves you, but it's a symbol of all these things that have already taken place. And baptism is this thing that is, I think, as a disciple maker, something that we need to remind people of. It's something like, hey, remember what baptism meant? Baptism, when you were baptized, it was you gave your life over to Jesus. And so when I'm sitting down with somebody, you know, and having a disciple-making relationship with them, I'm reminding them, hey, this area of your life really isn't under the authority of Jesus. We really want to help you kind of move towards that end. So what can we do to help get this area of your life where you said already in your baptism that you're surrendered to Jesus? Well, this part really isn't yet. So how can we help you move towards that end? That's what symbol of baptism. I think it's like not just a one-time event, but we need to keep reminding ourselves and others, this is what we made a commitment to. It's coming under the lordship of Jesus in every possible way. And then there's the teaching part. And teaching doesn't mean, Jesus doesn't say, go and teach them in classrooms. He doesn't teach in seminaries. I mean, classrooms are great and seminaries are great. But how did Jesus teach? It was incredibly informal. It was, hey, you know, we're going this way and we'll stop and look at this tree and let's talk about this tree and let me give you a lesson. Or you've heard it's been said and I'll just tell you this. And so it wasn't like they sit down, okay, class, let's open up and, you know, start working. It's so informal. And yet, every time he's like pointing them back to him. And that's what disciple making is. It's hey, let's sit down together, open our Bibles, and let's look at the life of Jesus. Let's look at who he is. Let's look and see how we can become more like him. He says, that's what I want you to do. Going, baptizing, teaching. And then he says this, and surely I am with you always, to the very end of the age. Something so, I would think, imagine, so comforting to hear because of just the task at hand. The mission, the vision is so large, so big. Jesus, we're going to need you every step of the way. And Jesus is like, you got me every step of the way. I will be with you. Don't you worry. But if you notice, and that's it. I mean, Matthew's over. It's like, okay, well, wait a minute. Like, we got questions, Jesus. Like, can you give us more than just going, baptizing, teaching? Can you give us like more like detail than that? And Jesus doesn't do that. Why not? Well, for those disciples who were there, those 11 disciples for sure, they knew what Jesus meant because they had just spent the last 3 years watching Jesus, hearing from Jesus, imitating Jesus. They knew what Jesus meant by go make disciples. They knew what it meant to go and make other disciples, to do it like Jesus did. So for us as a church, we promote, we encourage, we practice what we would call Jesus-style disciple-making. We think one-on-one or two-on-one kind of relationships are the best way to help reproduce ourselves and others. We need to be relational, we need to be intentional, and we need to be personable. We need to open our lives up. Just as Jesus invited these guys in and said, just look at my life. Watch me. Come with me and watch me. Come be with me. That's what disciple making is. It's doing life together. It's not sitting in a classroom. It's, you know, going out and at, you know, sitting at Panera. It's like, hey, let's sit and talk. Let's open up the scriptures. Hey, can I meet you at your workplace? You know, can you show me around your work? You know, just I've never been at your workplace. You know, just, you know, show me what you do. It's just doing life on life together in ways that I think we just don't do very often. But Jesus says, I want you to go reproduce yourself. Now, I've given this illustration before, so if you know the answer, don't give me an answer, but let me, is that an apple? You got an apple? Can I have that apple? Okay, thank you. That was so staged, gave him that apple. Let me ask you this question. And if you know the answer, don't shout it out, because let people wrestle with this for a second. What's the fruit of an apple tree? What's the fruit of an apple tree? Okay, someone give me an answer. No. No. An apple tree. See, the fruit of an apple tree is other apple trees. The reason an apple tree makes an apple isn't to simply make an apple. It's to make other apple trees. Jesus was telling these guys, I want you to become an apple tree to make other apple trees. We think of ourselves as a church oftentimes as an apple tree together, and we're making apples. We're not making apples here. We're making apple trees that make other apple trees that make apple trees. See, what the world needs isn't just apples. The world needs apple trees, followers of Jesus, people who are more like Jesus. I think we can all agree, whether you're Republican, Democrat, Libertarian, Conservative, Liberal, whatever it is, wouldn't you wish our politicians were a little bit more like Jesus, or a lot more like Jesus? Don't you wish your boss was more like Jesus? Don't you wish your spouse was more like, don't answer that one. Don't you wish that we were all more like Jesus? Isn't that what the world needs? Guys, this is what our endeavor is here. We take Jesus' words very seriously because he, we believe, has all the authority in heaven and earth. He calls the shots in our lives. And he says, go and make disciples. Go and make disciples. And notice, he doesn't give a plan B. There's no plan B. There's no, you know, if the old disciple thing doesn't work out, if you're not that, you know, if you're more introvert, I get it, you know, how about we just do a classroom video thing, you know? Well, let's just, you know, make seminaries or make whatever. He doesn't do that. There is no plan B. This is how Jesus plans on changing the world. One apple tree after another, multiplying ourselves. That's what we do here. But somewhere along the line, the church lost its focus. Somewhere along the line, being a disciple or being a Christian somehow equated into a church attender. Just, we're going to go to church. That's what we do. That's what Christians do. We go to church. Yeah, we may serve. We may help out. We give a little, whatever. But at the end of the day, that's what Christians are known to do. We go to church. We gather together. And I'm not saying anything wrong with gathering together. We're going to talk about how gathering together is so important. But that's what it became synonymous with, going to church. Are you a Christian? Well, I go to church. Well, okay, I guess that makes you a Christian. Guys, being a disciple, and always the case, was synonymous with going out and making other disciples. Because that's what Jesus told us to do. So when it comes to our vision here, our vision, we said, is in three parts. Our third part, our third dimension to our vision is this, is to see ordinary church attenders become extraordinary disciple makers. So ordinary, run-of-the-mill, everyday people, because that's who Jesus picked. He didn't pick the most gifted, the most talented, the best of the best. He just went out and just ordinary people. Peter, Andrew, James, John, come on. Come follow me. And we take ordinary church attenders, people who have been maybe sitting in rows or pews for all of their lives, and say, you know what? God has called you to something better and greater than that. He's called you to become a disciple maker, an extraordinary disciple maker. And by extraordinary, we don't mean that, you know, gifted and talented and extroverted and all those kind of things. Extraordinarily simply means focused, committed. Like an Alex Honnold who said, you know what, I'm going to reorient my life to this end. I'll do other things and I'll have other things, but that is my primary focus. Because that's what it takes to be extraordinary. It's focus. So that's the question. Am I focused on disciple making? That's the question I would just love to ask you. Am I focused on disciple making? Am I focused on reproducing myself in others? If the answer is no, we'd love to help you. We'd love to encourage you. We'd love to help equip you. I'm just curious, how many, and if you don't raise your hand, don't feel bad, but just how many of you are in a disciple-making relationship right now with somebody? Raise your hand. This is great. Okay? A few years ago, we would have had like maybe one hand or no hands. So we're making progress. My vision for our church is to at least see half the people in our room anytime say, yep, I'm in a disciple-making relationship. I'd love to see that come soon. Guys, this is what we need to be about more than anything else. This is how we rescue people, restore, transform. It's through disciple-making. This is Jesus' plan A all along. So let me just recap real quick. Our vision is to see the hopelessly lost become happily found. Because Jesus is so concerned. He came to seek and save that which is lost. To see the desperately broken become divinely restored. Guys, we live in a broken world, and Jesus says, I'm making all things new. All things new. To restore marriages, to restore relationships. We'd love to see people come out of bondage of sin and brokenness and despair and realize Jesus offers freedom and grace and mercy and a new start. We'd love to help people do that. And ultimately, how do we do all this? It's not through a class. It's not through a program. It's not through a seminar. It's not here's a track. Here's a book to read. It's by life on life disciple making. Seeing the ordinary church attender realize God's vision for their life to become an extraordinary disciple maker, an apple tree that makes apple trees after apple tree after apple tree. My hope and my prayer is at the end of my life, I'll have people standing at my funeral saying, I am so glad Dave invested in me. He helped me, he pointed me to understanding how to love God and how to love others so much better. He helped me study the scriptures. He opened up his life to me, and forever, you know, he changed my life. I would love to see men after men after men after men be able to stand up, generation after generation. Apple tree after apple tree. And I know for some of us, we are distracted. We are distracted. And sometimes the church does not help in that, and I apologize. But we need to get even more focused. And if there are things in your life you're like, you know, I wish I could, but I got this hang up, I got this issue, I got this thing that I feel like I can never do that because I keep coming back to this thing, and who wants to follow, you know, and become like me because I got this whole thing going on here. And I'm broken, and I just feel like I'm enslaved to the sin, you know, whatever that may be. We would love to talk with you about that. We'd love to pray with you about that. I'm going to invite our team of people who are designed, who are equipped to do that, to come up front right now. If God is, again, poking at your heart, saying, you know what, there's areas in your life where there's an obstacle there to getting to becoming a disciple maker. That there's something that you're not willing to let go of, something that you need to you know, just bring it to the light. We'd love to pray about that with you. But this is our call, guys. There's nothing else. And some of you guys, let me just talk to you guys real quick for a second. Some of you guys are extraordinarily lonely, and some of you guys have a feeling of purposelessness in your life. I understand that. Disciple-making fixes both of those problems. You will find an incredible purpose that you'll never lose. And you'll enjoy relationships, depths of relationships you maybe never had before. I'm telling you, you're missing out if you're not investing in multiplying yourself and other people. What's holding you back? Maybe you need to ask God right now. So we're going to pray. If you want to come up, make your way up as we pray, I invite you to do that. But this is our vision, guys. It's not just for 2020. It's not like a New Year's resolution. This is what we're doing as a church. This is who we are. This is what we have set our sights on until the end comes.